Good evening, I'm Nick Schifrin. Amna Nawaz and Jeff Bennett are away. On the NewsHour tonight, the death toll of one of Russia's deadliest attacks of the war rises as Western nations pledged more advanced military aid. President Biden faces intensifying Republican scrutiny over the classified documents found at his Delaware home. And the Greek government prosecutes the activists who are trying to save migrant lives.
They want to punish me and also to prevent me from continuing this kind of work, and a warning to all other humanitarian workers.
A final round of rain and snow fell on California today as the waterlogged state looks forward to drier days ahead. Nine so-called atmospheric rivers have battered California since late December. At least 19 people have died. More than 8 million are under a flood watch. Cars were left stranded in the streets of San Diego over the weekend, overtaken by flooding from the Tijuana River. Farther north, drivers in the Sierra Nevada braved whiteout conditions in spite of avalanche warnings. Across the state, thousands have been forced to evacuate. One man near San Francisco has been seeking refuge along the roadside for days.
My tools are here. It's over $3,000 worth of tools to fix and repair everything. And this will probably get ruined, my weed whacker. All this stuff I can't afford. You know, I had to buy this tank just to get gas in it from the RV. It's been crazy, man.
While drier conditions are expected starting tomorrow, the risk of mudslides will linger on since the state is so saturated. In Nepal, search teams retrieve the flight data and cockpit voice recorders from the site of the country's deadliest plane crash in 30 years. Relatives waited outside hospitals to retrieve bodies of the 69 people who died after the passenger plane went down Sunday in the Himalayan foothills. At the crash scene, rescuers searched for three missing people. Nearby residents described a horrifying scene.
I live in the house just next to the crash site. The plane crashed right across my house on a cliff. One of its wings still lies on the edge of the cliff. It came to the side of my house after bouncing back and then burst into flames.
Investigators have yet to determine what caused the crash. It happened just before landing at the airport on a mild day with little wind. President Biden marked this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday by paying tribute to the slain civil rights leader's legacy. At a breakfast event in Washington, Mr. Biden called on a divided nation to live by Dr. King's example.
This is a time for choosing. Will we choose democracy over autocracy, or community over chaos, love over hate? These are the questions of our time that I ran for president to try to help answer, and that Dr. King's life and legacy, in my view, show us the way forward. We just have to look back. We got to be prepared.
In Atlanta today, King's youngest daughter, the Reverend Bernice King, urged all politicians to live her father's message 365 days of the year and not just quote him on the holiday. Police in Sicily have captured Italy's most wanted mafia boss, who has been on the run for more than three decades. Officers today escorted Matteo Messina Denaro from a health clinic in Palermo, where he'd been using a fake name. Denaro was still considered one of the heads of the notorious Cosa Nostra crime syndicate. He'd been sentenced in absentia for a string of brutal murders and bomb attacks in the 1990s. In West Africa, the government of Burkina Faso says armed militants kidnapped around 50 women while they were out gathering food. The two sets of abductions happened late last week near the northern town of Arbinda, part of a region under the control of extremist groups since last year. A jihadist insurgency has overrun parts of Burkina Faso since 2015, killing thousands and displacing nearly 2 million people. An Italian film actress, Gina Lollobrigida, died today in Rome. Lollobrigida rose to fame in the 50s and was dubbed the most beautiful woman in the world after the title of one of her movies. She won a Golden Globe for her role in Come September, starring alongside Rock Hudson. She was also an accomplished painter and photographer. Gina Lollobrigida was 95 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the latest on the classified documents found at President Biden's home. A new sculpture is unveiled in remembrance of Martin Luther King, Jr. And an investigation delves into the disparity of black representation among NFL players and coaches, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, the death toll from a Russian strike in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro rose to 40, with dozens still missing. It was one of the deadliest single incidents of the war and comes at the beginning of a pivotal week for Western efforts to provide Ukraine heavy weapons, including tanks. Rescue efforts in Dnipro continue, but officials acknowledge that there is little hope of finding anyone alive. In the residential building that is torn in two, death is still far too easy to find. Today, emergency workers hope to rescue the injured. So far, they've only needed body bags. Across the street, a makeshift memorial. In a war that has already caused so much destruction and stolen even the most innocent, neighbors wonder why they survived and can only hope their prayers protect the dead.
All of us could be in that place. People, children.
Saturday's strike buried hundreds of people under the rubble. The Russian missile hit in the middle of a residential neighborhood, one of Russia's deadliest attacks on civilians in nearly 11 months of war. It struck at night. The massive apartment complex it hit obliterated. The pain of a mother who watched her son die, unspeakable.
What did you kill him for? What did you do to my son? May you be damned for the whole of your lives by everybody, by me personally, and by all the mother's tears.
The attack coincided with the Orthodox New Year, celebrated by both Ukrainians and Russians. Online, Ukrainians post videos of families inside the apartment building before and the same kitchen after it was ripped open. President Volodymyr Zelensky called it terrorism and said Ukraine would not lose hope.
We are fighting for every person. The rescue operation will last as long as there is even the slightest chance to save lives.
And he used the attack to once again criticize Russians for not criticizing the war enough.
I want to say to all those in Russia and from Russia, your cowardly silence, your attempt to wait out what is happening, will only end with the same terrorists coming for you one day.
Today, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the building was actually struck by a Ukrainian missile.
The Russian armed forces do not strike neither residential buildings nor the sites of civilian infrastructure. The strikes are aimed at military targets.
To strengthen its military, Ukraine has asked for Western tanks to upgrade its mostly Soviet-era armor. And now, for the first time, the West will provide them. This weekend, the United Kingdom announced it will send 14 Challenger 2 tanks. Today in Parliament, British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the tanks would help Ukraine achieve, quote, victory. And he urged Germany to send its tanks, the Leopard 2, which Ukraine has prioritized.
There's a debate in Germany at the moment about whether a tank is an offensive weapon or a defensive weapon. Well, depends what you're using it for. If you're using it to defend your country, I would wager that it is a defensive weapon system.
They have better battlefield mobility. They bring more firepower, and most importantly, they bring much more sophisticated targeting capabilities, allowing them to shoot and kill first on the battlefield.
Retired General Philip Breedlove is the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and the U.S.'s top European commander. Tactically, how much of a difference can 14 British tanks really make to the Ukrainian army?
Tactically, very little. But in breaking that policy hold on this kind of equipment, we hope now that nations will begin to supply more sufficient numbers that will then have a big effect on the battlefield.
Poland has promised to send its Leopards, and Finland could follow if Germany gives approval. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki.
The battle for our freedom, our future, is raging as we speak. And if we have been investing for years in heavy war equipment, in tanks, they must not be left to rust in storehouses, but be placed in the hands of Europe's defenders.
Ukraine urges the U.S. to follow with its M1A1 Abrams tanks. And Breedlove and others urge the U.S. to go further and send longer-range systems the administration has so far blocked for fear of escalating the war. Do you think Washington should be afraid of escalation?
Well, to say that we shouldn't consider it and think about it would be foolish. But to be deterred by it, which I believe we are in a large way deterred by this fear, that is a problem. The bottom line is right now, speed is of the essence.
But right now, there's little Ukraine can do to prevent Russian strikes on civilians. And so Ukrainians fear they face more days like today.
The White House confirmed today there are no visitor logs for the president's Delaware home, where the president's lawyers found additional documents with potentially classified markings. Laura Barrón-López brings us here, is with me here now, and brings us up to speed. Laura, welcome. So what did the White House say today about these visitor logs?
So White House spokesperson for the White House counsel's office, Ian Sam, said that there are no visitor logs for the president's Wilmington home, that that is a personal residence, and in keeping with past traditions for presidents, that's personal. They're not going to keep records there. But that the White House, of course, has visitor logs, and they reinstated that after President Biden's predecessor did away with those. This response from the White House comes after House Republicans, in particular Congressman Jim Comer, who's going to lead the Oversight Committee, said that requested those logs and asked for them, even though they never asked for them in the case of the seizure of classified documents from former President Trump.
And obviously, this is after additional documents were found in Wilmington over the weekend. What do we know at this point about those?
So we have a little bit more of a fleshed-out timeline here that was partially provided by President Biden's private lawyer. So on November 2nd, 2022, Biden's attorneys find documents at the Penn Biden Center, immediately notify archives. November 9th, 2022, DOJ launches its assessment. Then December 20th, 2022, President Biden's attorneys find documents at his Wilmington residence inside the garage, and they notify the DOJ. Then, just last week, January 11th of this year, Biden's attorneys find one potentially classified document, again, one single document in the Wilmington residence. And then January 12th, DOJ takes possession of those five additional documents found at the Wilmington residence. And that was a new revelation over this weekend, was that those five additional documents. One thing here is, of course, that the White House is facing a lot of questions about transparency. That's a political issue for them because the president has prided himself on having a transparent White House. But legally, there is nothing requiring the White House or even former President Trump's in his case or DOJ or National Archives to disclose when they've found these documents to the public.
Mostly, of course, those questions that you just mentioned are coming from Republicans who are in charge of the House now, and they say they plan to investigate President Biden's handling of these documents. What are those questions? What are those Republicans focusing on?
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy just said today that, of course, he wants as much information as possible. But Congressman Jim Comer, who I mentioned earlier, who's going to chair oversight, admitted that this isn't necessarily about classified documents for House Republicans.
At the end of the day, my biggest concern isn't the classified documents, to be honest with you. My concern is how there's such a discrepancy in how former President Trump was treated by raiding Mar-a-Lago, by getting the security cameras, by taking pictures of documents on the floor, by going through Melania's closet, versus Joe Biden. They're like, okay, you're personal lawyers who don't have security clearance. You know, they can go through.
Congressman Comer said right there that this is about the difference in treatment. Well, there's a very real factual reasons why President Trump was treated differently. He withheld these documents for more than a year, and so did his team. And DOJ, National Archives, expended a lot of different steps to try to get these documents back. And it wasn't until a judge signed off on a search warrant, because they had real concern that the former president was obstructing the ability to obtain these documents and was also potentially violating the Espionage Act. I think it's also important to note that as Republicans widely are calling for more information on Biden, they have not said that they would investigate former President Trump's classified documents at all.
And quickly, Laura, how are Democrats in Congress responding at this point?
Right. So Congressman Adam Schiff, as well as a number of other Democrats, have been calling for a damage assessment. And here's what Congressman Schiff had to say this weekend.
I think Congress ought to handle both situations the same way, and that is we have to get a briefing from the intelligence community about any potential risk to national security of where those documents were and what they contained.
So just like they called for in the case of President Trump's classified documents, Democrats are again calling for a damage assessment, which is very common when classified documents are found where they're not supposed to be found.
Laura Baron Lopez, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On this Martin Luther King Day, we have a look at a new memorial in Boston honoring Dr. King and his wife, Coretta Scott King. It has been 5 years in the making, and the project honors their relationship and their dual civil rights legacy. Jeffrey Brown has a story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
In 1964, 35-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. celebrated his Nobel Peace Prize with an embrace of his wife, Coretta. Now, another celebration based on that moment. The unveiling of a 20-foot-tall, 19-ton bronze sculpture called The Embrace, depicting four intertwined arms, on Boston Common, the nation's oldest public park. Ja Amazi was part of the architectural team.
It is very hard for me, as a daughter of Boston, to maintain composure and not bawl out. As a young black architect educated in this city, to participate in a moment like this, where we honor the black experience, black joy, black love.
King had important ties to the city. He attended Boston University, earning a PhD from the School of Theology. And this is where he met and began dating the young Coretta. The city was also a locus of his civil rights work. In 1965, he led a march from Roxbury to Boston Common, one of the first such marches in the North. At Friday's opening ceremony, Martin Luther King III and his daughter, MLK's granddaughter, Yolanda Renee King, were among the speakers.
They both love this city because of its proud heritage as a hotbed of the abolitionist movement and its unique intellectual and educational resources. And indeed, Boston became the place where they forged a partnership that would change America.
I love this monument. I also see the love and strength and unity in these hands and how they symbolize a beautiful marriage and partnership. And it was one that changed the world. There is a sense in which we are all children and grandchildren of Martin and Coretta Scott King. We are all challenged to carry forward their unfinished work.
Earlier today, I spoke to Hank Willis Thomas, the artist who designed the sculpture, and Marie St. Fleur, the former head of Embrace Boston, the nonprofit group that spearheaded the memorial.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Hank Willis Thomas, you were inspired by that photograph. What did you see in it that you wanted to bring out?
Well, when I saw that photograph of Dr. and Mrs. King on the day that he received the Nobel Prize, I saw this incredible bond and that it wasn't just his celebration, it was their celebration. I saw the warmth of the hug and the power of that embrace. And I saw her strength literally holding him up throughout all of these different trials and tribulations, and the fact that she was with him every step of the way and then carried on the legacy after he was assassinated was something that I really felt needed to be highlighted with this work.
Notably, no faces, no full bodies. It's, in that sense, not a traditional monument. I have seen some pushback, people questioning the way you approach this. Were you thinking of doing something different? How did you approach it?
I think too much burden is placed on Dr. and Mrs. King and people that we see like them to do the work that's important to changing society. And I wanted to make a piece that both acknowledged and highlighted them, but also was a call to action, a call to love for everyone to embrace someone else and to kind of honor them by stepping into their power, their beauty, and their message. And so the embrace is as much about the potential that exists in each and every one of us as it is about Dr. and Mrs. King.
Marie St. Fleur, Martin Luther King Jr. is, of course, well-remembered often for his work in the South, for the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, perhaps less so for this his time and his work in the North. How important was Boston to him, and why is Boston honoring him now?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing is it started here, right?
because this is here where Martin and Coretta met. It is here that we have this full love story that not so simply celebrate Martin and Coretta, but love stories that happens in Black community, and that not simply in Boston, but across this country and this nation. And what it does is it shows you the first, you know, super couple who are able to come together, not only for career, but for love of community, for love of country, and to galvanize a movement, happened right here in Boston, and very few people knew that. And it celebrates that for us as communities of color, as Black people, that we are more than just our struggle. We are love, we are joy, we are all of that. And that, to me, gets represented at the center of the oldest park in this country.
He would have seen that Boston of the past, though, right? He would have experienced some of that racial tension that existed in the city.
Absolutely.
What did he experience, and how does that play into what you see today?
Well, I think he saw the poverty that existed in Boston at the time, particularly in communities of color. He saw the pain, the unemployment. He saw the lack of education that was an unequitable education that was being offered in public schools in the city of Boston at the time. He saw it and he wanted to do something about it. And so I do think that while it may have show up differently than it did in the South, a lot of what was happening in the South, it was more subliminally present in the North. And he was willing to meet with us, to dine with us, to plan with us, and then to act. And as you know, he came back and led that march and actually addressed a bicameral session of the legislature to really challenge us to think differently about how we approach the issues of race right here in the city of Boston.
And Hank Willis Thomas, I mean, we are in this moment where we're thinking a lot about how we remember history, about monuments and memorials. I know you've been involved in making public sculptures before. Now you're taking on this. How do you think about what should be in the public, what we should look at, and how we should remember important figures and history?
As a society, we have a negativity bias. We seem to only highlight things that are either, and also that are like horrible. You know, most of the things that we have monuments to in our society are monuments to heroes of war and victims of war. We don't have very many monuments to love and to the community. And so I really feel like it's time in the 21st century to reconsider what the role of public space is and why we gather around them. The Embrace is an opportunity for people to actually come together and really reflect on the power of any two people coming together and embracing, and the potential of that to change the society for the better.
And Marie St. Fleur, this is the oldest public space in the country. And in thinking about how we remember our past, what is it that you want people just walking through Boston Common to take from this?
I know Hank has brought us such joy. I have to tell you, it's complex, right? What I want them to understand is that Boston belongs to all of us. And I think for me that it's the Embrace as well as Freedom Plaza. It's a recognition, again, it's uplifting in that it talks about joy, it talks about togetherness, and it talks about our ability to overcome. And at the same time, it recognizes that we didn't do it alone, and that Dr. King, when he was here in Coretta, when she was here, they worked with a community of people. And the people that he worked with that really impacted and tried and really drove change in the city of Boston are reflected on that common as well. Dr. King and Coretta Scott King were global citizens. Whoever walks into our city tomorrow will be able to see themselves, see their struggle, see their joy, see their love right there in the middle of America's most famous square, the Boston Common.
Marie St. Fleur, Hank Willis Thomas, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Coming up on the NewsHour, how climate change makes intense winter weather events like the Buffalo Blizzard more common. And a new book examines the biggest myths about the United States' past. The EU says the number of migrants entering Europe last year hit a six-year high to well over 100,000. That is a 50% increase over the previous year. But Greece has been prosecuting the humanitarian workers who try to save asylum seekers at sea. And the UN and the EU say those prosecutions are having a chilling effect. Now a court case could prolong migrants' uncertainty. Here's special correspondent Malcolm Brabant.
Slogans outside a court on the Greek island of Lesbos encapsulate concerns of the UN and EU's human rights commissioners. They're appalled that 24 search and rescue volunteers face long jail sentences for trying to save lives. The best-known defendant is Sarah Mardini, a Syrian refugee whose heroism has been immortalized in a Netflix movie called The Swimmers.
I was arrested because I was giving water and blankets.
He says he can get us on a boat to Greece.
There's no more room in the boat.
The film shows how Sarah and her sister swam through the night to pull their refugee dinghy to Lesbos. Later, Sarah became a volunteer on the island and spent 4 months in jail after her arrest.
I survived the war, and I survived the crossing with the water, and I was completely fine. And just because of this situation, I just lost control of myself and my mental health.
Sarah didn't attend the hearing in Lesbos, but Sean Binder, her former colleague, did. The charge sheet includes espionage, forgery, people smuggling, money laundering, and belonging to a criminal organization.
Can you just describe to me what you think of the charges against you?
I think in a word, they're farcical. There's this idea that I am some naive utopian who doesn't understand how the world works, and I'm told that I should have just followed the law. Well, that's exactly what I'm doing. What does the European Convention of Human Rights say about the right to life? It says we must protect it.
Can I ask why you've decided to go back to Greece for the trial? Because you face a long term in jail.
That's right. I face 20 years imprisonment. It is important that we stand up to these kinds of prosecutions, these cynical prosecutions.
Prosecutors are also gunning for Panayiotis Dimitras, one of Greece's most prominent human rights activists and a fierce critic of Europe's refugee policies.
The West fears the refugees, and they are willing to do anything because they have no respect for human rights to stop that flow. And that if the victims are refugees turned back, refugees killed, drowned, NGOs being harassed, they don't care.
The News Hour met Dimitras during a 2021 investigation on the island of Samos into the case of a Central African refugee who was pushed back after landing in Greece. This Turkish drone footage appears to capture a pushback as a Greek ship casts adrift asylum seekers towards Turkish territorial waters. Greece's Supreme Court has received dozens of lawsuits from Dimitras about such incidents. Now he's been accused of people smuggling and forming a criminal organization. What do you think the Greek authorities are trying to do to you?
The main cause is retaliation. They want to punish me and also to prevent me from continuing this kind of work so as to have a free hand and a warning to all other humanitarian workers to stay away from that.
Identical charges have been filed against Tommy Olsen. He runs the Aegean Boat Report website that monitors refugee traffic. Although Olsen is based in northern Norway, asylum seekers frequently ask for his help while at sea.
No water, nothing, nothing. He will die with the baby and he will be happy.
Following this slew of prosecutions, the UN and EU are calling on Greece to allow humanitarians to work free from fear of legal action. Greece's location makes it a magnet for asylum seekers. Its coast guards have saved thousands of lives since the refugee crisis began in 2015. But the government is exasperated by the refusal of other Europeans to share its burden. Out at sea, Greece is embroiled in a propaganda war with Turkey, which has been paid billions by Europe to stem the migrant flow. This Greek video shows a Turkish vessel destabilizing an asylum seeker's raft. Turkey's Coast Guard responds with images of alleged pushbacks. Greece's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis.
We are intercepting boats that come from Turkey
as we have the right to do. This is our policy. We will stand by it, and I will not accept anyone pointing the finger to this government and accusing it of inhumane behavior.
According to the Aegean boat report, more than 26,000 people were pushed back by the Greek authorities in 2022. As a result, some smugglers send overcrowded boats from Turkey to Italy, bypassing southern Greece. In rough seas last October, a vessel carrying 100 people struck rocks off the island of Kythira. At least five drowned. Survivors were hauled up a sheer cliff face. Search and rescue volunteers have been frightened away from Greek islands by prosecutions. And the hearing in Lesbos has done nothing to change the climate. Charges of spying and other misdemeanors were shelved because of technicalities. But serious felony allegations are still hanging over Sean Binder and his colleagues.
All we want is justice. We want this to go to trial. And it doesn't seem like that will happen anytime soon.
The non-profits insist they aren't the pull factor that lures asylum seekers to Greece.
The refugees are not coming for me. They want safety. Mm-hmm. They're not coming to take your jobs. They're not coming to take your money. They're not taking to take your life. They want safety. They want to just sleep at bed and not hear a war happening outside of the window.
The key question is, how will the Greek government respond to the UN and EU demands? Compliance or defiance? Either way, the migrants will keep coming, risking everything in the process. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
This past weekend, the NFL playoffs got underway, but for black coaches last week brought negative news and, once again, tough questions about the league's record when it comes to who is hired to be a head coach. Lisa Desjardins has the story.
Nick, the Houston Texans fired head coach Lovie Smith last week after a 3-win and 13-loss season that many saw as a rebuilding year. That leaves just two full-time black head coaches out of the 32 spots in the NFL. One other interim coach is black. This in a league where nearly 60% of the players are black. That gap has been an issue for decades. Back in 2003, the NFL adopted what's known as the Rooney Rule to ensure teams interviewed at least one minority candidate for every open head coach job. Here's what that recently fired coach, Lovie Smith, told the Washington Post last summer about being a black head coach.
And there was pressure to win, and you really wanted to, but you knew it was a lot bigger than that. If you didn't win, you're going to stop progress. You're going to knock us back a little bit. And that's pressure that I still feel. We get a shorter period of time to prove exactly who we are.
The Washington Post has chronicled this problem in detail in a series called Blackout. Michael Lee is part of the Post team that worked on that and joins me now. Michael, my first question is, why is this not only a continued problem, but it seems this is a problem that is actually getting worse in the NFL right now?
Yeah, it definitely is getting worse. Lovie Smith was, you know, as you just said, was fired after one season. And the guy, you know, came after David Culley was given one season as well. In the last, since 2018, five black coaches have been fired and three have been fired after just one season. And I think that's a problem that really needs to be addressed. The NFL is doing all that it can, but one of the issues is with ownership, and they haven't been willing to provide opportunities for black coaches. And it is getting worse, and there doesn't appear to be anything that can change it other than the owners having a change of heart.
Let's talk about that issue with NFL owners for a second. This is not a diverse group. In fact, there have never been a majority owner of an NFL team that's been black, very few non-white owners of any sort. Can this problem change at all? You're saying it sounds like no, unless the owners change. How does that happen?
Well, I think one thing we have to look at is we look at the history of the Rooney Rule, which came in place in 2003. That was brought about through the threat of litigation. Cyrus Merry and Johnny Cochran, you know, threatened to sue the NFL in order to change their policies, because at the time Tony Dungy was the only, or he had just been fired, and Herm Edwards was the only black coach left in the NFL. And so 20 years later, you wound up with the same cycle, but this time you actually have a court case with Brian Flores suing the NFL. You had a litigant. You had someone who was willing to put his career on the line and force change through the courts. And I think that's the one thing that changes the climate right now for the NFL, because they've been put on alert to say that there is a serious problem. And I think the owners have to be the ones to make the decision.
We know that Flores lawsuit you mentioned is working its way through the courts still. You know, this isn't just about hiring, but it also seems to be about firing as well. You mentioned that idea that coaches in the recent years, coaches who've been fired after just 1 year, half of them have been black. And here is something that you talked to another former head coach about from the Washington Post. This is Romeo Crennel, what he said about that.
I think sometimes the minority may not be given as much leeway as a white counterpart. Now, in saying that, I mean, I think if a white guy was a head coach and he was doing a bad job, he gets fired too. If you're doing, let's say, an above average job, all right, sometimes a white guy might be given another game where a black guy might be let go.
What are your findings about the role of race versus the role of team records in firing in the NFL?
Well, black coaches are most likely to be fired after having success than a white coach. If you are a black coach who wins 9 games, you're just as likely to be fired as a white coach who won 6 games. And you're also going to be the first one to be dismissed in short order. There was some progress there around 2011, where there were 10 coaches, 7 full-time and 3 interims. And it's appeared that the NFL was moving in the right direction. But in the last decade, things have regressed to the point where now, again, you have a lawsuit in place, but you also have coaches who are expressing their frustration because there's a pool of talent that's available if owners are willing to actually hire them. And it's interesting to see where this lawsuit goes, because that appears to be the only way that could get someone to move. Otherwise, there'll just be a lot of complaints and frustration from guys who are qualified who continue to see the goalposts move.
You know, preparing for this segment, and I am a big football fan, one number popped out at me that I was surprised by. Of the 100 most watched broadcasts last year in the U.S., 82 of them were NFL games. That's staggering. Yeah. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. This is a huge part of life in America. So I want to wrap this up and ask you, what do you think is at stake here in this discussion for the United States, for the culture, in terms of who the NFL chooses to elevate?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, Cyrus Mary, one of the attorneys who threatened to sue the NFL 20 years ago, he always said if you could change football, you could change America. And I think that says a lot about the power and influence that the game has on the entire country. If owners were willing to provide opportunities for minorities and actually put them in leadership positions, it might change the way people around the world see that representation. It may open up corporate America, Fortune 500 companies, to see leaders in those positions. I mean, you look at just what happened on the field. It took a long time for quarterbacks to get, black quarterbacks to get opportunities. But now the game is so much more exciting when you have a Patrick Mahomes kind of freestyling and throwing, you know, sidearm passes and doing so many exciting things. I think one of the things that black coaches, whatever level they're on, they just want an opportunity, the same opportunity that white coaches are given. There's no proof that a white coach is any better or worse than a black coach. The opportunities, though, for them are much better. And that has to change, because there's no reason why we continue to have this conversation, and there's no reason why it can't change until the owners decide that they want to make that change. And there has to be pressure somehow, and it's either going to come through financial pressure, lawsuits, or something of that magnitude. But fans themselves, they're never going to break from the game. They love it too much. It'd just be better if they provide opportunities to more people.
Big game, big season, and a big topic. Michael Lew, The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
California continues to be inundated by storms, and millions of residents remain under flood watch. Western New York is still recovering from last month's historic blizzard that dumped more than 4 feet of snow on Buffalo. Lara Barón-López is back and examines the frequency of extreme winter weather and the debate about its potential links to climate change.
Longtime Buffalo residents had never seen a winter storm quite like this one. Morris Singer III says for much of the city's Christmas week blizzard, he was doing wellness checks as part of a volunteer group in his East Buffalo neighborhood. He shot this video in near whiteout conditions.
And you've lived in Buffalo your whole life, right? I mean, have you ever seen a storm like that?
Not like that, especially with the wind. The wind just made it just extra worse than what it was.
Morris later found out that his own father was among the more than 40 residents killed in and around Buffalo as a result of the blizzard. 65-year-old Morris Singer Jr., a man known for his flashy suits, died trying to walk to a grocery store as the storm hit. His body was later found in a snowbank.
He was so, like, flamboyant, larger than life, wanted to be seen. So his personality was the same. So, you know, they told me he was going to the store. And unfortunately, the store is only two blocks over. And he didn't make it.
The blizzard conditions, coupled with 70-mile-per-hour winds, were a catastrophic combination. Climatologist Adam Smith calculates the financial costs of weather-related disasters for NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information.
And unfortunately, the late December 22 winter storm cold wave was, in some parts of the country, a storm of a lifetime. Just the hurricane-force winds around Buffalo and just the intense snow squalls, It was quite remarkable.
Smith says the blizzard was just one of 18 separate billion-dollar weather and climate disasters in the United States last year. And he believes it could end up being the costliest winter weather event in roughly 2 years when nearly 250 people died in Texas.
And so in 2021, February was the most costly winter storm cold wave on record, which we remember the Texas energy grid froze. Many other states experienced a lot of damage from just the cold. It was over a $20 billion event.
Well, it's increasingly clear that other severe types of weather, like the recent flooding in California, droughts, and longer wildfire seasons, all can be linked to global warming. The fingerprints of man-made climate change on extreme winter weather is less obvious. That debate often centers around the Arctic, a region warming nearly four times faster than the rest of the world.
The biggest changes we're seeing with climate change are happening in the Arctic. I think there's a connection.
Climate scientist Dr. Judah Cohen studies the links between Arctic warming and disruptions to the polar vortex, the swirling winds above the North Pole.
Our argument is that changes in the Arctic are leading to more of these disruptions of the polar vortex, which increases our risk of severe winter weather.
For most Americans, winters are getting both shorter and warmer across much of the U.S. Average winter temperatures have risen by at least 2 degrees since the 1970s. But Judah Cohen says something else is happening.
What people are actually experiencing is a warmer, shorter winter punctuated by more of these severe winter weather events.
Cohen's research is not fully agreed upon among scientists. Some argue that cold weather, even when severe, could simply be a natural deviation from a general warming trend. What's clear, the increasing frequency of extreme weather means more Americans will likely be impacted going forward. And some groups will be hit much harder than others, says Adam Smith.
Most everyone is vulnerable to some extreme or combination of extremes. And certainly people who have highest socioeconomic vulnerability to these different extremes often might not have, you know, a vehicle to evacuate. They might not have a home insurance policy to help recover from damages. So they might not have the social fabric to help them rebound after these extremes.
There's an old adage in the African-American community that says when white people get a cold, Black people get pneumonia.
Urban Studies professor Henry Louis Taylor Jr. says that Buffalo's mostly Black East Side was especially vulnerable to this blizzard. Many residents there live in older homes and often rely on walking.
Already we know that Blacks represented about 50% or more of the fatalities in a region where they represent only about 14% of the population. This was something you had never seen before. The messaging was never there. It was never there that walking could kill you.
A driving ban remains in effect.
While the city of Buffalo did institute both a driving ban and urged residents to stay home during the blizzard, Morris Singer III says it was a message that never reached his father.
This is probably the worst storm that any of us have experienced in our lifetime. And we just didn't know any better because people were still going out, like my father, still thinking that hey, this is all right, I can walk to the store, I can make it, that this isn't going to kill me.
Does that make you angry with the city of Buffalo for how they handled the storm?
I'm a little frustrated because I still think it's a lack of accountability with 43 people dying.
Like many in Buffalo, Singer says he hopes last month's blizzard will be a wake-up call for the city as it prepares for future extreme storms. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone Lopez.
In recent years, there has been a steady increase of misinformation. Two historians have assembled a team to push back on what they call myths surrounding some of the country's most pressing issues and defining moments. They recently spoke with Jeff Bennett about their new collection, Myth America: Historians Take on the Biggest Legends and Lies About Our Past.
Kevin Cruz and Julian Salazar, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
The book's essays take on everything from feminism to white backlash over the removal of Confederate monuments, to American exceptionalism, to Trump's America First approach. Kevin, what for you was the organizing principle behind this book of essays?
Well, our main purpose was to push back against some of the lies and myths that are out there in public discourse today. So certain topics presented themselves as obvious ones, but the more we got into it, we wanted to give a full picture of the range of American history and the misrepresentations about them.
And Julian, why publish a book like this now?
Well, part of it was us listening and hearing and reading ideas about American history that were really disconnected from what academic historians have been writing about and finding in the archives. And we wanted to try to share with the public what we know that's so different than what you hear. Part of it is also how politicized history has become in the classrooms. And we wanted to bring some of the best and brightest scholars who write well, to tackle big questions that Americans have been wrestling with, not just over the last few years, but over the last few decades.
Well, let's talk about some of the essays, starting with Sarah Churchwell's essay titled America First. She writes of the phrase of the worldview revived by Donald Trump. She says, America First has never been and was never intended to be a simple statement of patriotic self-interest, and it has certainly never worked as a unifying national motto. On the contrary, it has consistently served as a divisive code camouflaged by its ostensible harmlessness, a frequently conspiratorial cover story for internal power struggles. Julian, tell me more about the origins of this myth of America First and how it has evolved.
Well, look, America First really became part of the national lexicon in the last few years when the former president used it as one of his mottos. But it's a term that's been around for a long time, certainly in the World War II period and in the period leading up to World War II. It was a term embraced not just by those who supported isolationism, but many who were connected to the right. And Sarah, in her essay, really shows a long history of how this term, it's not just a patriotic motto, it's really a concept, a phrase that's been connected to many elements of reactionary politics from the World War II period right through today.
And Glenda Gilmore, Kevin, writes about the myth of the so-called good protest, which she posits is based on the nonviolent resistance of the civil rights movement. And she says the narrative rests on four misconceptions: that the demonstrations from 1955 to 1968 were the first of their kind, that most Americans gave their support to the protests and their leaders, that they quickly exposed and vanquished hatred, and that they ended happily by bringing racial equality to America. Why is the myth of the good protest so dangerous as you see it, Kevin?
Well, it's dangerous because it presents a false split between the past and the present. There are those who held up this false idea that the civil rights movement was one that wasn't controversial, that settled things easily, that Martin Luther King was universally adored for what he did. All things were false at the time. It was deeply contested and contentious in the 1960s. But if you have a view of the civil rights movement in the 60s as being kind of anodyne, without any stakes to it, without any opponents to it, then it makes other protests pale in comparison, right? And so the Black Lives Matter protests were constantly contrasted against this false image of the civil rights struggle, when, as Glenda notes in her essay, there's actually a great deal of continuum between them.
Historian David Bell writes about the perceived myth of American exceptionalism. He is dismissive of the term, and his rationale seems to be that most nations can be considered exceptional in one sense or another. I think people might read that and take issue with it. How do you defend the position that he takes, Julian?
Well, the idea of American exceptionalism has been around for a long time. It's been embraced by the left and the right. It's a real bipartisan argument. The idea that America, it's not simply better than other nations, it's fundamentally different, that we have avoided all the problems that face other comparable countries with regard to class relations, race relations, and more. And what he is trying to argue is that really skews our understanding of how the United States evolved. It's better to have a realistic understanding, to know some of the similarities between our other our country and comparable nations in Western Europe, for example, because then we get a deeper knowledge about how we as a country have wrestled with those problems, sometimes differently than others and sometimes the same. So, you know, I think what David argues is very important, and he shows there's a history to the concept. It's been deployed politically, and often it takes our eye away from issues that we need to address as a nation.
The book, its essays, isolate members of the conservative movement as the main culprits of misinformation, of disinformation, and of myth-making. There are people who will read the book. There are people who will watch this interview and wonder what exists of the lies and legends, to use the phrase I read in the book, promulgated by the political left.
But it's a fair question. And I'd say that the reason there's so much emphasis in the book on myths and misrepresentations of history coming from the right is that they've been actively engaged with history in the last few years. I mean, President Trump led the way, not just in terms of his claims to have been the best or the biggest or the first to do such and such, but even in the last days of his presidency, putting forth this 7076 commission report, which tried to inculcate a patriotic education, they called it. So the right has been very engaged in this project, and that's why I think you've seen historians pushing back more against lies from the right. I think if we had if Biden tries to push a patriotic education, we'll see certainly historians try to push back against that as well.
And I would add that we frame the book around the moment we're living in and where really a lot of this is most pronounced.
You are both historians with significant public profiles. Do you feel like the moment in which we're living, rife with misinformation, requires historians to venture outside of academia into the mainstream to combat some of this stuff head on?
Yeah, absolutely. Historians have a special set of expertise, and there's a hunger in the public to understand this nation's history and its meaning for the present, and historians have an ability to fill that gap. And luckily, we live in an era of social media, which has unfortunately helped a lot of these myths and lies spread, but it's also given every historian, every political scientist, every scholar out there an ability, a platform to push back against them.
Julian Seltzer and Kevin Cruz, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Remember, we have much more online, including a story on where activists seeking to eliminate abortion are now focusing their energies. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Nick Schifrin. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, I hope you had a good day. Thank you, and have a good night.